Welcome to the Pinkleton Pull Aside podcast. On this podcast, let's step aside from our busy lives to have fun, fascinating, life-giving conversation with inspiring authors, pastors, sports personalities, and other influencers, leaders, and followers. Sit back, grab some coffee, or head down the road, and let's get the good and gold from today's guest. Here's Jeff Pinkleton, Executive Director of the Gathering of the Miami Valley, where their mission is to connect men to men and men to God.
Hello, friends. Welcome again today to another episode of the Pinkleton Pull Aside podcast, where we like to talk all things life, leadership, lessons therein. And we tend to do that in the world of sports, of music, of comedy, of authors and books, pastors, business, great stories, current events, the like. And today we'll be killing a couple birds with one stone with that, with Michael Graham, who is the, I think I got the title right, program director for the new Keller Center. I know it's longer than Keller Center. Go ahead, Michael, set me straight. Your title is?
Yes. Yeah, program director for the Keller Center for Cultural Apologetics.
Man, that sounds so cool. That is everything about that. Just the word Keller, obviously, grabs everybody's attention because we're clearly referring to Tim Keller. And how long have you been in that role, Michael?
Well, we launched about a year ago, a little over a year ago, and it took about a year to get everything kind of ready pre-launch. So been in this role for about 2 years.
And did you, I assume, know Tim Keller?
You know, oddly enough, we were on a handful of Zoom calls together, but we never met in real life. So like most people, it's probably a good thing for me to be in the spot where I'm at, because I think that's kind of where most people are at, unless you were in New York City or somewhere there in New England.
So since that, I'm sure you're going to get asked many a times over and have already about Tim Keller. What's maybe something out of the box or unorthodox that when you look back over his life, I don't know if you read the book that Colin Hanson wrote, or obviously Keller, we've used a couple of his books in my ministry, The Gathering. What about Keller is what you kind of hold on to and remember most or think about most when you think about how he lived his life and his ministry and preaching and books and everything else that goes with that?
Tim embodied what I call quiet, calm curiosity. Hmm. He always stayed emotionally well-regulated. He read very widely. He was always curious and asked good questions. And he was a good active listener. There's a theologian here in Orlando where I live named John Frame. And Frame has published very prolifically, more in the academic realm than, say, Christian living or practical ministry things. Mm-hmm. But Frame outlined this particular thing called triperspectivalism. And that's just a fancy word for, because God is triune and we are made in his image, there are aspects of his triunity that are reflected in us, particularly the idea that we have knowing, being, and doing, head, heart, and hands. In his words, he calls it the normative, situational, and existential perspectives. I think the strength of, Tim was that he brought together three very different streams that didn't always interact very well or even play well with each other. So he brought the kind of Reformed, particularly like the Dutch Reformed perspective, in conversation with kind of the individual pietistic heart type thing, and then together with the missional perspective, all at the same, all those three things, those three streams at the same time. So I think, I think I'm probably the only other person in my lifetime who is similar, who would be internationally known, was maybe John Stott. So I think Keller was kind of America's John Stott. And I think that's why Keller resonates, is, he was able to be in a, very large and very highly secular city, but be able to teach extremely faithfully and preach from God's word from a historic Protestant vantage point. So I'm grateful for Tim, but primarily for that quiet, calm curiosity as manifested through an excellent balance of head, heart, and hands.
Mm. Yeah, there's so much that could be said about him. I'm sure many a podcast could just spend all their time talking about him. But Michael, it's always good to hear people's testimony. Give us your 3-minute, what was God doing work in your life as you came to him? What was it like coming to him, and so on and so forth until where we are now?
So my parents were first generation Christians. I grew up in the Midwest. Well, I was born in the Midwest and grew up in Florida. And my parents had never been discipled. And so we ended up in some not so healthy churches growing up. As a result of that, I was an atheist in my kind of middle school years. And then it was a small group Bible study, inductive Bible study of the book of Galatians, my freshman year in high school, where the gospel first made sense to me and probably became a Christian for the first time. So after that, just went on to undergrad at University of Florida, was heavily involved with an evangelical free church there and Campus Crusade for Christ, now called CRU. Mm-hmm. After undergrad, went overseas with CRU to Italy, first in Pisa in the north and then Salerno in the southwest.
So you had to suffer for Jesus for a while, right?
You know, Italy's a complex place. I could talk a lot about it. In many ways, it was like getting in a time machine for the future of, you know, of ministry in America, because everything was kind of broken over there. And you had a strong, legitimate secular left versus a strong secular right. Its institutions were eroding. Society was very strained. And yet we were able to be very successful in our mission over there and have both thriving campus ministry and local church planted there. So because of my experiences, and Jim was also in Italy, my co-author on The Great Dechurching. Because of that, we don't really freak out here in America when things are, you know, maybe eroding culturally or when there's concerning things, because we've, you know, had a lot of ministry success in a society that's dramatically more dire than anything that we'll ever see in our lifetimes in the United States. So after my time with CRU in Europe, came back, did MDiv at RTS Orlando, then did church planting and church revitalization in Raleigh, North Carolina for a few years, and then came back, had a career in finance, was CFO of a tech company, had a retirement estate planning practice for 6 years, and then spent before my 2 years with the Keller Center, had a decade as executive pastor at Orlando Grace Church in Orlando, Florida. So that's kind of the
Michael, you don't look there. 85 years old. How did you just fit all that into that time capsule? That's a whole lot of stuff for a guy that doesn't look anywhere close to, how old are you?
I'm in my mid-40s. I'm a lot older than what I look.
That's a whole lot of stuff. I mean, that's a full resume for anybody, probably three resumes for most.
Yep.
For me, as an outsider looking in here, what all you just said, that's something to me that says, man, I would be grateful for that, because that gives you a well-rounded approach to about anything. So how does that background you have, as you said, you have a co-author, Jim, but how does your particular perspective land in this book, The Great Dechurching, when you've got that vast array of experience in church world and, you know, somewhat rebellion? You said middle school years, you know, you were atheistic and, you know, you've been to Italy, you've been all over the place. How does that fit with this book?
Yeah. So my life didn't make a whole lot of sense before the last 2 years. The character Joseph, you know, in Genesis 37 to 50 is probably the person who I most resonate in terms of just my life with, because not necessarily having, you know, I just have one brother, not 11, but just the very roundabout and seemingly random experiences, all of which don't really make a whole lot of sense until middle age. And then being then entrusted with a lot of things, and particularly from an operations perspective in a number two role. And so, yeah, most of my life hasn't made a whole lot of sense until the last few years, where, and now, you know, I pretty much draw upon everything that I've gleaned from operations, finance, math, spreadsheets, forecasting, teaching, and my own personal experiences, both with atheism and church hurt.
Yeah. I'm already seeing why Drew Flam, I didn't mention it out of the gate, how we're connected. Drew Flam and you were in Dallas, I think, together, and he spoke highly of you. And I said, would he be a guy worth getting on the podcast? He said, absolutely. And I can tell why already. So when you looked at this project, I don't know if you or Jim started it first, going down this road, why did you say in current culture, this is something I absolutely have to be a part of, because obviously this is going on in our culture. People are leaving. The stats you have in the book are pretty fascinating. There's other books out right now kind of talking about this. People who are probably making careers out of this. Why did you have to be a part of this?
Well, Jim and I are both really curious people, and we're always asking ourselves, like, are we doing our jobs pastorally in our city of Orlando? And we had run across some data about 6 years ago that had said that our context was upwards of 42% dechurched. And that sent us kind of on a wild goose chase pastorally to figure out, okay, well, that's a lot of people. In our metro area, that's 2 million people. You know, and it made sense because it's like our city is 6% evangelical. Well, that's the same level as Seattle and New York City. But why does Orlando feel different than Seattle or New York City? And it's because Orlando is a dechurched context and those two cities are unchurched contexts. The difference being dechurched people are people who had used to go to church of some sort on a monthly basis, and unchurched being people who have never had, you know, that kind of habit of, you know, monthly or more frequent church going than that. And so we needed data that was actionable pastorally and for people in our church. And so we went on a hunt to try to find data that was actionable to figure out, who are all these people? How many of them are there? Why did they leave? Are they willing to return, and under what conditions? And so when we went to try to go find that information, it just didn't exist. There was some data that could get you, you know, some sketches, but it was like a lot of that data was over a decade old. It wasn't academically credible, not large sample sizes. And, you know, a lot's happened, you know, in the last 10 years. And so, you know, we needed really granular data that could give us a sense of what was going on so that we could make decisions from a philosophy of ministry that were clear and, you know, backed by, you know, hard information. And so we were never intending to write a book. We were only going to commission this study for the purpose of our podcast, As in Heaven. And it just so happened that as we were talking with some people about what we were finding from our findings, they were like, well, guys, can we please try to convince you, even though you might not see yourselves as authors, to just go ahead and write this into a book as well, because it would be irresponsible for you to be sitting on all this really important information and only release it in basically audio format. So kind of in the 11th hour, we engaged a few publishers. They were very excited about it. And so we ended up writing the book.
So tell us, A, what are some of the things that are either, I want to stay away from the word alarming, but I don't know what word I want to use more that really needs to grab us. Because I think about people kind of in three categories here of what we're talking about, which is people in the church following Jesus, passionate about him, that even they need revival. People who are walking away who obviously, you know, we want to see come back. And then people who are unchurched, as you said, who are just that are unchurched. And then maybe with some of what we talk about, I think it's easy, and correct me if I'm wrong here, I think it's easy to validate any reason why someone walks away. And sometimes to me, it's just like, buck up, I work with men, be a man, be a woman, whatever. And that's a stupid, dumb, ridiculous reason to not be involved in a church anymore. People are people, hurt people, hurt people. You know, we're broken. We need to be broken. Stick with it. So what did you find that we really need to hear? And what's legitimately validated? And what's kind of like, people need to toughen up here?
Yeah. Okay. So there's three questions there. I'll try to answer them.
There's probably eight of them actually, but.
Yeah. The most alarming thing was, you know, from the first phase of our study, and that was basically the size, scope, and quickness of this phenomenon. So what we're looking at is 1 in 6 adult Americans, that's 40 million US adults, used to go to church on a monthly basis, but now don't at all. And almost all of those people have left in the last 25 to 30 years. And just for sake of perspective, this is the largest and fastest religious shift in our entire country's history. It's larger than the First Great Awakening, Second Great Awakening, and all of the Billy Graham Crusades combined. And it is a religious shift that is faster than any other 25 to 30 year shift in our country's history. And so that was really concerning. There are a number of other very concerning things that are maybe a little bit more niche, maybe we'll get to, maybe we won't. But the things of which, you know, what we need to be able to hear is we discovered a lot more hope than what we anticipated in this process. Before we did this research, I think there were basically two stories that had been told for why people had been leaving, you know, church. If your media diet leaned a little bit left, the story that was told was, well, people have left church because churches have made mistakes, and they've made mistakes around areas like racism, misogyny, clergy scandal, clergy abuse, and political syncretism, Christian nationalism. Okay. If your media diet leaned a little bit to the right, the story that had been told there was that, well, people have left church because of secular progressivism, the sexual revolution, and these kinds of things. And what we saw in the data was, well, neither of those stories are false. Both of those stories are, to a degree, they're true. You can find a few million people that fit both of those stories. However, the most important stories that we learned was a really boring story. And the really boring story is that most people didn't leave, you know, based on those other two stories. They left for very pragmatic and pedestrian, frankly, not very good reasons, like things like I moved, or attendance was inconvenient, or I had some kind of family change like marriage, divorce, remarriage, or the birth of a child. And so, but the good news about the boring story I can do something about. The first two stories, the kind of, you know, slightly left story and the slightly right story, well, can I do anything at the national scale on racism, misogyny, clergy scandal, clergy abuse, Christian nationalism, political syncretism, or the sexual revolution or secular progressivism? No, I don't have agency as an individual on any of those things, nor does even any institution, whether it's my local church or any other institution that I'm, you know, can we make a dent really on any of those things at the national scale? No, we can't. And so the conversation had gotten stuck. But what was really encouraging is when you're talking about people leaving church primarily, you know, where three quarters of the people who are leaving for very what we called casual reasons and unintentional reasons, the casually de-churched leaving for, you know, moving and attendance is inconvenient and some kind of family change. Well, guess what? Over half the people who left evangelical churches are willing to return today. And the reasons why they told us they were willing to return are frankly very doable. It's basically they're looking for good relationships and a healthy local church. And so, well, those are things that are very much within our power and within our control. And so I think the internet is in why those first two stories were the way that they were is that the internet is functions like a funhouse mirror. If you ever been to the county fair or whatever, and you had the funhouse mirror that's kind of, you know, undulating and whatnot, what does it do? Well, it makes certain things larger than what they really are in real life, and it makes other things smaller than what they are in real life. And so data is nice because data can give you a nice flat mirror where you can get a more accurate snapshot of what we're looking at. And so the good news is when we relate to people with, you know, relational wisdom and we build healthier local churches, and, you know, we talk about how, you know, a healthy local church is one that emphasizes the truth, the goodness, and the beauty of the gospel in one roof. And so when we do those two things, those are things that, broadly speaking, the particularly the casually de-churched are looking for.
I look at this and I think you mentioned relationships and you look at a healthy church. Let me just cut to the chase. Do you think there are people who passionately follow Jesus, understand whatever term of discipleship we could get to and say it's important, and yes, this is discipleship? Are there people living in that sphere who have left the church? Or, I mean, that almost seems like it can't be possible to me. That's my very black and white, I'm going to call a spade argument, that it's hard to passionately follow Jesus, be a disciple, and not be a part of the church. Debunk that thought of mine.
I can't debunk that thought theologically. Okay. You know, obviously we've all read, you know, Hebrews 10, 24 and 25, you know, and the warnings against, you know, forsaking the gathering of the church. From a data standpoint, what I can say of the 40 million people who dechurched, 15 million left evangelical churches. Of those 15 million, it looks like about 5 million of them very much understand the gospel and believe it. About 10 million look like they don't understand Nicene Creed level Christianity. And so one of the profiles, so in the book, we spend four chapters unpacking four different evangelical dechurch profiles. You can read The Great Dechurching to, you know, get all that granular information. We don't have the time to unpack each of those things. But one of those profiles, the mainstream dechurched evangelicals, this is 2.5 million people. They very much seem regenerate. They seem to be serious about their faith. They did leave relatively recently around the time of COVID. They didn't leave for very good reasons. It was all casual by and large. And 100% of them are willing to return to an evangelical church. And so those folks seem to very much not just like, I think there's like in some ways kind of three conversions inside of the Christian faith. Mm-hmm. You have the, you know, the conversion to Christ, you have the conversion to the church, and then you have the conversion to the world. I'm borrowing this from Steve Childers, who was the professor of evangelism at RTS Orlando for 30 years. But the conversion to, you know, the gospel is Christ is very straightforward. But then when people become convinced, oh, like the church is a good thing, I need to be connected to that. And then the conversion to the world is basically the idea that I am an ambassador of Jesus, and he has placed me sovereignly in where I'm, where I live, work, and play to be, to help the people who I'm around have a missionary encounter mm-hmm. with Jesus. And so I would say the mainstream dechurch evangelicals, 2.5 million people, at least have those first two conversions that are there. They know that they should be back in church. And so in the book, we talk about how there's three levels of need with dechurched people. And really the level of need in terms of how we relate to them depends on which profile they're in. That's why you really do need to read The Great Dechurching so that you can just get a sense of
the plug.
Like,
let's do it.
Because like there's at least six different types of dechurched persons, and how you relate to each of them, what's wise, looks very, very sure. different. And the dechurched are very much not monolithic. And so, but with this particular group, they just need the first level of need, which is a nudge. When you have somebody who's in that particular profile, you invite them to return to church, water cooler, text, phone call, conversation at the cul-de-sac or at the sideline of the, you know, the kids' sport games. They always come. They just do. You know, I can tell you story after story of, you know, basically batting 1,000, inviting, you know, that particular profile back to church, whether that's my stories, Jim's stories, or, you know, hundreds of people that have, you know, sent us emails about, you know, hey, this, you know, thank you for this profile on the mainstream dechurched yeah. evangelicals. It gave me confidence. So, yeah, that maybe gives a little bit of nuance there.
So speak a little bit more, because I don't think we hit on it enough. Speak a little bit more to the conversion to the world. I think that's very interesting because you said it usually stops at the first two. Talk more about, because I know when people hear the conversion to the world, that almost sounds reverse the, like that theology doesn't, you're talking about adapting or buying into the world, which is not what you're saying. So unpack that conversion experience with the world a little bit more.
Yeah. So obviously we want to see ourselves as being converted to Jesus so that we, you know, it's him alone that's providing salvation. We want to be converted to the church in the sense that this is God's plan A for the world. And we shouldn't be forsaking. When you look at the 59 one another's in the New Testament, you can't do most of them unless you're a regular churchgoer. And then that third conversion, though, is where do we see ourselves in the unfolding of the kingdom of God? Are we observers or are we active participants? And I think it's important that we grow in our active participation in those things, because while God is sovereign and in control, he's chosen to use his church and he's chosen to use his believer priests, us, to be his, you know, his ambassadors. And he's placed us with a purpose. He's put us in the neighborhoods that we have, in the jobs that we hold, and with the relationships that we have, that our spouses have, that our kids have. All of those things are part of his divine plan. And he wants us to have more joy in him by telling other people about the most important things about who we are and what drives us and what is the source of the hope that we have.
You know, for me to dumb that down, one of the things I think, if I could take the famous Abraham Kuyper quote about there's not one square inch of the world that God doesn't says that's mine, it's almost like we're joining the Trinity in that. We're going with where Holy Spirit goes, speaking about Jesus as God guides and directs us as well, to say we're joining that work. Would you say that's fair to say?
That's 100% the case. You know, and I mean, if you're listening to this, one thing that I want everybody who's listening to this to take away is this. I want to inspire you to take relational risk. Let me unpack what I mean by that. So who does God want you to invest in? I'm going to tell you very simply, we'll get charismatic here for a second. I'm going to tell you who God wants you to invest in. He wants you to invest in people who he is consistently putting right in front of you. If God is putting somebody consistently right in front of you, you know, I want to encourage you to take relational risk with that person. Now, for some people, that's going to look like a nudge. For other people, that needs to be something like your dinner table. And for other people, it's going to look a lot longer, just years and maybe even decades of just consistent friendship. It just depends on where somebody is at, you know, with respect to, you know, how near or far are they from the Lord, and what's the sum total of their experiences with Jesus, with the church, with Christians, and these different kinds of things.
You know what I love about what you said there? When I hear stuff sometimes or think about practical, I need to have a name come to my mind. And I was thinking about, I spent a lot of time at Panera, and I was thinking about a young person who works there, who that person has landed in my space outside of my work life a couple different times. And I think they see a safety and they know what I do, that if they have something come up into their world where they have a question, a concern, they need help, they need resourcing, they've reached out to me. Well, sometimes it's me sending them a scripture. Sometimes it's me saying, hey, here's a place where I think you could go, or here's someone I know that you know that I think you should talk to, you know, whatever. It's like, you know, it's actually someone of the opposite sex, so I'm not going to spend a bunch of time with them and they're 19, 20 years old. But I'm like, okay, what's the deposit I can make to give them a little something? Whereas it's someone who, okay, that's a person I could actively be meeting with weekly and disciple and be about the gospel fully, everything that's about in their life. So I love how you said that. So Michael, let me ask you this. You've referenced healthy church, and I know that's something that's going to be important in this equation. I preached yesterday, and I've preached it over, I think, 40 churches as a parachurch guy who people want me to talk about either men or whatever world I'm in and knowing people to fill pulpits. A church of 50 to 100 that's healthy probably looks different than a mega church that's healthy. What are some core key components that you and Jim would say are important for our churches to be healthy?
So we built an entire website around best practices for local churches on this de-churching question. So the website, you can pull out your phone or whatever and look at it or whatever. It's dechurching.com. Really hard to remember, dechurching.com. And we built a resource there that's both a free 20-point audit of different ways that you can, different things that definitely highly impact dechurching, where you can basically take that audit and see, okay, how are we doing on things like, do we have a church membership process? When people move, that's an emergency, dechurching wise. So what's our plan on arrivals and what's our plan on departures? How do we meet the people who are coming to our community? And how do we stay and follow up with people who used to be church members here, but moved to a different place? And are we staying with them all the way until the point where they found a new local church? Things like assimilation processes, clarity on things like mental health and pastoral counseling and pastoral care. Do you have processes in place for abuse prevention? And then all sorts of different things in terms of how we equip our people. What are the physical needs in our community that are unmet by various different other nonprofits or government? And what are the spiritual needs of the community? In other words, every different community has, I think almost all of evangelism and discipleship comes down to two things. What does somebody want and what are they afraid of?
Wow. Okay.
So I think about wants and fears. And just like individuals have wants and fears, communities have wants and fears. And so anytime I'm in a new place, I'm asking myself, well, what does this community want and what are they afraid of? And how does, what part of the gospel story speaks to those wants and what part of those of the gospel story speaks to that community's fears? And so those are the things that I'm wanting to communicate as, you know, a kind of ambassador or missionary, so to speak, to help the community see those things. So I think about the physical and spiritual needs together. I like Tim Keller's Ministries of Mercy, the third edition. And then when you're talking about differences in church size, this is free. You can Google Tim Keller's PDF on church size and leadership dynamics. Tim Keller's church size and leadership dynamics. He talks about how there's basically five different sizes of church. And he talks about the leadership dynamics needed in each of them. Going back to though to dechurching.com and the church audit there, we also built a paid resource there on that site. If, like, you know, if you're a local church, you're a pastor, or you're an elder, and you feel like, oh, we need basically worksheets, project management worksheets on how to get better on each of those 20 areas, we built that there on that site as well. So there's just a lot of, you know, best practices. But at the end of the day, we want churches to know, to have a membership process, know your people. And here's how you know whether you know your people or not. Can your elders or whatever the church polity is in your tradition, can they pray? Can every one of those leaders pray with specificity for every single household, at least one thing that's unique for that household? If your elders can't pray with specificity for every single church member household, then you don't know your people. And you need to be upgrading your systems in terms of how it is that you, you know, that you shepherd, and how it is that you know the, you know, the people in your church, and what are your pathways for, what is your game plan for spiritual formation and discipleship of your people? There's no shortcut for church always really boiling down to evangelism and discipleship. Yeah. That's been what we've been handed down for 2,000 years. And I think, thankfully, the time for transfer growth between churches and the merry-go-round of, you know, churches trading cards with each other, I think that that is slowing down, and I think rightly so. And I think we have to get back to the basics of just evangelism and discipleship. And when we look at the beliefs of many of the dechurched, of, you know, the 10 million of the 15 million who don't even hold to basically the Nicene Creed, it seems obvious that there's been real discipleship failures at many of the places where these people used to go to church.
So there is so much in what you just said. I want to catch, again, I don't want people to miss this. You referenced two key discipleship points for the local church, and it's answering the questions. And to correct me if I'm wrong here with how I worded that. What does this community want? What is this community afraid of? Is that right? Those are two key discipleship points?
Yeah, wants are more important than needs. Needs are boring. wants get at the heart.
Yeah.
And so do fears.
And now your elder comment you made about elders need to be able to say they can pray for each member of the household, each member household. Let me make sure that people understand what that is. Each member household uniquely. I bet you're going to get some pushback on that because people don't want to face the reality that they can't answer that. That is a very powerful, like I'm right now making some notes and I'm thinking, wonder what my elders would say to that one. But I feel like you're onto something that like they probably better be able to do that.
Well, what our elders do is they have two meetings a month. One meeting is basically talking through the business philosophy of ministry and decision points of the church. And then the other meeting is praying through the entire church directory from top to bottom. And making sure that if we haven't seen anybody for a while, just checking in and seeing, hey, are you okay? Not in any kind of over shepherding or getting, you know, anywhere, you know, with a country mile of abuse and those different kinds of things, but just like, hey, I really miss you guys. Are you guys okay? Is there any, you know, is there anything that we can do to love you and care for you and serve you? Look, systems can be really boring. Okay. But sometimes we want to do church in a way that's decent and orderly. And so sometimes you need clarity on your systems in order to be able to, you know, this is the ministry of organization. We want to do church and decently and in an orderly manner. And so we also send out a quarterly, you know, automatic email that asks for prayer requests for every single person, you know, in our church. And at those monthly elder meetings, we pray for every single one of those things. And so you just have to have some, you know, it doesn't have to be anything terribly complicated. You just want to have systems for, well, how do we know our people besides just kind of organically having conversations on a Sunday morning?
I'll tell you what, you are making me want to go to Orlando Grace for about a month just to check out what this looks like, fleshing it out, so on and so forth. So one of the things I think that's probably important here that I think most people, especially on the other side who have walked away, would argue for this, and I want to know what you think. How important is the language we use? Words like de-church or re-church or deconstruct or nuns, all those kind of things, nuns being N-O-N-E-S. How much do we need to honor those words and treat them right? And how much are they just words and they're not that important?
Well, I like technical terms. And here's the value of a technical term. A technical term can be valuable in the sense when, instead of having, you know, hundreds of words or dozens of paragraphs kind of defining something and explaining it, you can say a particular term and communicate a lot of information very quickly. Now, the danger with technical terms is when a technical term is not tightly defined. So when we use technical terms that are unhelpfully broad, where, you know, and we've all had this, it's like, I remember, here's a secular example of it, not to be crass, but there's like that term hooked up. Well, I don't know what that means. You know, there could be a very wide semantic range of what a term like that means. And so I like having good definitions of technical terms, and I don't like using technical terms that don't, when you're in a broad group of people, where there's a different understanding of what a particular term means. So let me define a couple terms. So de-churching, that's somebody who used to go to church regularly on a monthly basis for a long period of time, and now goes less than once per year. So not even Christmas or Easter, okay? A nun, a religious nun, N-O-N-E, is somebody who self-identifies as either atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. Atheists and agnostics are not growing very fast. The category of the nuns that is growing very fast are the people who check the box, nothing in particular. That's the fastest growing religious self-identification in America and the West, is those who self-identify as nothing in particular. Rechurching is somebody who was churched, de-churched, and then returned. Okay. Then you have people. There's not a technical term for this one yet. Well, I'll probably end up coining it at some point. And that's somebody who was unchurched. So that's somebody who's never, unchurched means I've never had the habit of going to church on a monthly or more frequent basis. But then that person becomes churched. We don't have a technical term yet for what that person is. So on the unchurched to church shift. I don't think there's terribly many of those people, but there are some. And then the deconstruct term, we did not use that term at all in our book. And the reason why is because the semantic range of the term is very broad. It can mean everything from somebody who is disenculturating or disentangling their faith from subculture. In other words, somebody who's, I grew up with a lot of, there was Jesus, but there was a lot of subculture, okay? And where the subculture was extra biblical, and it was largely things like legalism and politics. Well, some people might say, well, Michael, you know, you deconstructed. And well, maybe kind of, but it's like, I think I would say, no, I disenculturated or I disentangled the subculture from the Jesus of the Bible. As opposed to, you know, deconstruction being a term that deals with somebody who has given up on core doctrines, maybe even essential doctrines of the Christian faith. So things pertaining to Jesus's divinity, the Trinity, penal substitutionary atonement, these different kinds of things. And so I don't care for the term deconstruction, because I don't know whether I'm dealing, when somebody uses that term, I don't know if they're talking about somebody who's leaving the faith or somebody who's maybe on a, maybe a healthy process of the kind of process that I had to go through to, you know, not growing up in healthy churches, having to deal with, okay, how much of this was like subculture that's outside the Bible? And I just want the, you know, the Jesus and the kingdom of God of the Bible. And so the other technical terms I'm very much fond of, and I think that those are things that we should have and hold on to and be crystal clear on. I wouldn't mind if the deconstruction term, you know, kind of went the way of the buffalo.
So what is the healthiest term if someone is taking a look at their faith, they're evaluating things, they're looking at the past, they're dealing with hurt? What's the term we can come to and say, ah, yes, that's the person we're, not that we don't want to address everybody, but what's the term we want to use for someone who's doing this in a healthy way? What's the best term?
Yeah, if I had a magic wand, I would reserve the term deconstruction for somebody who's leaving the faith. And then I would use the term disenculturation or disentangling for somebody who's trying to know the difference between the authentic Jesus of God's word and his kingdom and maybe a lot of unhelpful or less than helpful subculture.
I love the term disentangle. That's a good one. So let me ask you this. I live in a world at 54 years old with where I do ministry. I'm friends with a lot of senior pastors and youth pastors. I did youth ministry for over 2 decades. What should youth pastors and senior pastors hear and know and grab hold of to not feel overwhelmed, but to say, okay, this is my responsibility today to help in this topic? What can they be doing? What's not being overwhelmed, not getting blindsided and feeling like this is way too much, but how can they make a dent?
All right. So there's a lot of things that we can do that are just all low-hanging fruit. Number one, read the book. Number two, take that audit on dechurching.com and kind of take a good look at your institution. And then three, of all the things that we can do, I think if we just made a difference on the arrivals and departures side of people coming or leaving our communities, that's the place that's probably the lowest hanging fruit, is making sure that, okay, you know, we have the Smith household, you know, they're leaving our community and they're going 2 states over, or even, you know, 60 minutes away. Well, stay with that person all the way until they have found another good local church in their community. And you can teach your people, you know, in your congregation how to do this. Like, if you love somebody else in your church and they're moving, well, still love them. One, don't shed the relationship, but two, it's like move is a 4-letter word. You gotta, you know, maybe there's a buy and sell house, there's new schools, there's, you know, packing everything, unpacking everything. You could care about Jesus more than anything in the world. And that process right there of moving is still terrible and horribly time consuming. But let's say I'm just a regular church member, right? And not even clergy. Well, if I have a friend and they're moving, I can go on 6 or 10 different, you know, church websites, you know, look at the TGC church search engine or whatever. And I can look at those sites. I can listen to a couple sermons from them, and I can write up a digest for my friend. I can say, hey, I looked at these 6 to 10 churches. Yeah. I think these, you know, 3 or 4 are the most promising. I emailed some questions, you know, to some of the pastors. Here's some things that I heard. You know, would you consider, you know, spending 4 to 6 weeks at least 2 or 3 of these? And I'd love to just follow up with you, you know, in 2 months from now, 4 months from now, 6 months from now, and kind of see where you're at, and just in terms of, you know, finding another healthy local church. So I think those three things are just, okay, read the book so that you can understand and digest the profiles. Let what you learn from those profiles influence your preaching. And share whatever, you know, whatever actionable insights there are for your community, you know, let that be there in your preaching and teaching. And then among your elders or, you know, your kind of leadership team or staff team, talk through the dechurching.com audit. And then third, just at least have a process for how do people who are new into your community, how do they find your church? And then people who are moving from, you know, from your church, stay with them until they find you have that kind of pastoral handoff between your church and whatever church they end up landing at in their new community.
You know, what's so interesting about what you said, there's so much there. I'm highly encouraged by this conversation. I've purposely left off some questions I wanted to get to because we need to get back on here soon. I love a lot of what we didn't cover, but so much good that we need to stay at. But one of the things that I feel like you said without saying it is we just need to simply love people well. And loving people well is not in a moment. It's, you know, when you're talking about move being a four-letter word and all the ways, four layers to it, and going and helping people move, saying, hey, I found these church. I mean, those are just simple things. They take time. They take effort. But it's loving people well. And I think if we're doing that, some of the stuff you're talking about that's so overwhelming, studies, you know, the idea that people are going once a month to now less than once a year, you said they're not even seeing ears. It feels like to me there's hope in that, and that could quickly change. I've often said Bob Goff, a guy who's known to love people really well. When you read his books, if you ever hear him speak, he loves people well. I think he's scary to a lot of people because people don't want to think they can or should have to love as radically as he does. So, Michael, let's hit pause. I would love to get you back on here sooner than later. Where can people find out more about what you're up to? Obviously, they can go to Amazon or any place books are sold and know more about the book. But where else can people find out more about what you're up to?
Yeah, you can go to thekellercenter.org. And on that website, you'll see long form articles that we publish. You'll see online learning cohorts that we have. We'll have six of those here this year. So Cultural Apologetics 101 is going on right now. And then we have a cohort for pastors entitled Preaching in a Post-Christian World. And then we have another cohort on sexuality, singleness, and marriage. So you can find those long form articles and those online learning cohorts on thekellercenter.org. I'm somewhat on social media. I'm on Twitter at MSG Writes, W-R-I-T-E-S, MSG, like my initials. Yeah. Thank you, Mom and Dad.
And when I hear MSG, I'm thinking Madison Square Garden, but that's a whole different ballgame.
Yeah, or monosodium glutamate.
There you go.
The carcinogen. But but I'm not hyper. I'm not like a hyper online person.
Well, Michael, thanks for your time. Thanks for the gift that you and Jim Davis have. The great dechurching, who's leaving, why are they going, and what will it take to bring them back? I think it's a gift to the church. I'm excited between that and what you're doing with the Keller Center to get some of the pastors I know to get access and know what they have before them, especially a couple of my friends who just became senior leaders or senior pastors at churches that are kind of going through some struggles. And between what you're up to, the Rainers doing all the things that they're doing in their world with Church Answers, Barna, Van Blumen, that's not how you say it. How do you say?
What's Vander Blumen?
Yeah, Vander Blumen. Thank you. There's so much good resources out there for the church. So look forward to our next conversation, Michael.
Thank you, Jeff. Really appreciate you having me.
Thank you for joining us on the Pinkleton Pull Aside podcast. You can reach Jeff at gatheringmiamivalley.org or find us on Facebook at The Gathering of the Miami Valley. Join us again next week for another honest and rich conversation.
The Rise FM Podcast Network.